attention for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2020 Walter Magazine. We begin with the intrepid life of Dorothea Dix, how a self-educated runaway became an advocate for mental health, by Joel Haas. Dorothea Lynn Dix was more than a hospital or a park. In fact, Dix Hospital was not actually named for her, and she may have been outraged, or at least ambivalent, at the ground's new use as a park. An examination of her biographies, along with dozens of, quote, memorials, letters, speeches, and notes she penned herself, reveal a woman with an unusual path and sometimes contradictory views. Born in Hampton, Maine, in 1802, to an abusive religious fanatic father and a clinically depressed mother indifferent to her daughter, Dolly ran away at age 12 to live with her wealthy grandmother in Worcester, Massachusetts. The widow of a prominent Worcester physician and land speculator, Dr. Elijah Dix, this stern, pious taskmaster drilled into her granddaughter that gray areas did not exist. Self-educated and a voracious reader, Dolly Dix turned to teaching to earn money to bring her two much younger brothers to Worcester. At age 14, she opened a grammar school for girls of wealthy families. Her school was a success. Dix was deeply religious and felt bound to open a free evening school for poor girls. Her perfectionism drove her to rise early, then stay up late, grading papers and writing lesson plans. By age 19, she was using one school to support the other, while running her aging grandmother's estate. In 1831, she collapsed with exhaustion and coughed blood from tuberculosis. To recover, she took a less onerous job, tutoring the children of a prominent Rhode Island Unitarian preacher, Reverend William Channing. Channing's family adored her and took her twice with them in summertime to St. Croix, then a Danish colony. While in St. Croix, she expanded her passion for studying nature. She sought out plants, animals, birds, whatever would stand still, to study and illustrate with meticulous watercolors. She continued to collect rocks, plants, and any other natural phenomena in her future travels. In the Caribbean, she saw slavery for the first time. Her strict sense of morality gave her a strange outlook. She wrote that she, quote, envied the slaves' carefree attitudes towards life. It seems that by her own uptight New England upbringing, it seemed impossible to be both pious and cheerful. It would be immoral, she declared, for her to teach slaves these principles and thereby make them unhappy. The sinners were the owners, she said, who shirked their Christian duty to teach slaves morality. As her health recovered, Dix returned to teaching and took up writing. She produced the first handbook of American flowers in 1827, as well as several children's books. Her book, Conversations on Common Things, went into 60 printings in her lifetime. Her health collapsed again in 1836. Physicians recommended she go to Europe. Returning to Massachusetts, Dix learned that her grandmother had died, leaving behind a considerable fortune. Book royalties and this inheritance would enable Dix to live comfortably the rest of her life. By this time, she was 36, a wealthy spinster, but her intelligence and blunt, imperious manner seemingly dissuaded suitors, according to her biographers. Chance led her to take up social justice in a field that few people at the time even thought of. She was asked to teach Sunday school at the East Cambridge Women's Prison. She left her first Sunday visit horrified. She discovered women with mental illness, charged with no crimes, were nearly naked and fed scraps, chained in cells alongside the criminal population, standing and sleeping in their own waste. Confronted, the warden replied he conformed to all common practices and laws. After all, the women were consigned there by the county as, in the parlance of the time, quote, loony paupers. Dick set out to see for herself if the warden was lying. For 2 years, she visited every jail and poorhouse in the state. The warden wasn't lying. In some places, conditions were even worse. Between travels, she read widely on the, quote, insane and idiots, those we now refer to as people who have mental illness, and those who are born with intellectual or developmental disabilities, and met some of the leading experts of the day. The public's prevailing view at the time was these people were unaware of their surroundings. They were people without memories or feelings. Dix disagreed. Whether or not they could be cured, Dix believed society had a duty to treat people who have mental illness or who are born with intellectual or developmental disabilities with dignity, kindness, and employment. Dix persuaded a prominent sympathetic doctor, Dr. S.G. Howe, to write a newspaper article about her findings. The reaction was outrage. Surely conditions could not be so bad. To disprove her accusations, the Massachusetts legislature launched its own investigation. Finding her report accurate, in 1843, they approved construction of a state hospital. By then, Dix had set out to see conditions elsewhere. Traveling by boat, rail, wagon, horse, and on foot, she visited jails and poorhouses from New Hampshire to Louisiana. She successfully submitted memorials to legislators asking for funding to build hospitals to treat patients in New Jersey, Illinois, and Pennsylvania. In 1848, she came to North Carolina. Here she traveled to 40 counties, visiting jails and poorhouses. She persuaded a state senator to present her memorial of findings to the legislature. The reaction was polite but condescending. The North Carolina legislature supported, quote, lower taxes to attract business, end quote, over public welfare spending. A Yankee spinster's advice was not needed. The bill was rejected. By chance, Dick stayed in the same Raleigh hotel as a legislator named James C. Dobbins and his wife Louisa, who became deathly ill during her visit. Dix was her constant attendant and nurse, staying with her even after the hospital bill was defeated. On her deathbed, Louisa Dobbins made her husband promise to work to see Dix's bill passed. Soon after the funeral, Dobbins and Dix walked into the Capitol building's House chamber together. Dobbins reintroduced Dix's bill and, keeping his promise, worked to see it passed. By 1856, Dix Hospital had been completed in Raleigh. Out of modesty, she asked it be named for her physician grandfather, Dr. Elijah Dix. The name would be changed to Dorothea Dix in 2005. Leaving Raleigh, she moved on to successfully persuade Alabama and Mississippi to establish state hospitals. By 1858, she was one of the most widely known and admired women in America. She had so many friends across the country, she seldom had to book a hotel. Where she could not change a system, she raised money to send books and clothes to prisons and poorhouses. She lived on very little. Dix's reputation was so great that at the outbreak of the Civil War, she was appointed Superintendent of U.S. Army Women Nurses. She resigned her post in June 1865 and immediately returned to raising money for hospitals. By 1881, her respiratory problems returned and she was exhausted. No longer able to travel, she retired to the suite of rooms built years before in a New Jersey asylum for her use. From there, she continued advocating for the disadvantaged through her letter writing, which hardly slowed down. In 1887, at age 85, Dorothea Lynde Dix passed away. Starting in the late 1960s, Dix's legacy began crumbling. Buildings erected in the 1800s were outdated and hard to keep up. Dix desired to separate people with mental illness and developmental and intellectual disabilities from what she perceived as an unfriendly public, but practices turned toward integrating them into communities. Many of the 32 hospitals Dix founded or helped establish were closed, including Raleigh's Hospital. But what remains of Dix's legacy is twofold. To treat people with mental illness and developmental and intellectual disabilities with kindness and support, and to stop identifying their actions as criminal behavior. Dix's empathy, meticulous reporting, and dogged advocacy started a tidal societal shift. This article was edited for Time. From our locals department, Finn Cohen writes, "In Their Corner." Remy Fullwood uses boxing techniques and his own experience to help clients fight Parkinson's. On a Sunday night 3 years ago, Sylvia and Larry Thomason were watching the news in their Zebulon home when a report came on about an organization that uses boxing to treat people with Parkinson's disease. Larry Thomason, who'd just been diagnosed with the disease, immediately perked up. "That's what I want to be in," he told his wife. According to the report, boxing has well-documented benefits for people diagnosed with Parkinson's. The full-body sport relies on hand-eye coordination and balance, and drills that emphasize repeated movements that can help offset physical and cognitive degeneration. The next day, Sylvia Thomason started calling Triangle Area gyms to find availability. The first few gyms she called weren't able to give her specifics about their programs. But when she called a no-frills, sweat-stained gym tucked into a corner strip off Glenwood South, she reached Remy Fullwood. Fullwood, the owner of Jawbreaker Boxing, is a former professional boxer who's trained under a U.S. Olympic boxing coach. He also has multiple sclerosis, so he understands what it's like to have your body betray you. He told Sylvia Thomason to bring her husband in at the end of the week. "The first day, I basically had to pick Larry up out of his truck and put him in his wheelchair," says Fullwood of their first meeting. But that was the beginning of months of vigorous training. "Every day, I would just push Larry down to the end of the parking lot and make him walk his feet all the way back." Many Parkinson's training programs involve group classes, but Fullwood's program is built on a one-on-one rapport with his clients. "Jawbreaker currently has 5 Parkinson's clients," he says, "spread around several different trainers." For him, it's a way to give back and show people that having a disease isn't a reason to give up. "They actually got him doing sit-ups on the floor," Sylvia Thompson laughs, noting that her husband's progress has been well documented on Jawbreaker's social media pages. "Remy even got us ringside seats to a boxing match, which we'd never been to. And people lined up to see Larry like he was a celebrity because they'd seen him on Facebook." Fullwood grew up in Wilmington and played nearly every sport. Boxing, swimming, soccer, tennis, hockey, basketball, volleyball, and golf. I was a hell of an athlete, he says, chuckling, but I was a hell of a problem. After a year of high school, he got in enough trouble that he was sent to Hargrave Military Academy in Virginia, an experience that gave his natural abilities a side of self-discipline. He discovered a talent for football at Hargrave, then enrolled at North Carolina Central University, intending to play there as a walk-on. But one cold morning before the season started, as he dove into the campus pool for his morning swim, his body rebelled. I was telling my legs to move, but they weren't getting the message, he says. Fullwood had been experiencing symptoms like this for almost a decade. His natural athleticism had masked what was underneath, a gradual weakening of his nervous system from the progression of MS. After seeing a doctor and finally receiving a diagnosis, his college athletic career was over before it even began. Fullwood was determined to fight the disease however he could, so he turned to what he knew best, working out and following a strict diet. After college, he started a career as a personal trainer. He was also teaching some kickboxing classes at Fit 24, a gym located on Capitol Boulevard, when he came across a group of professional boxers that changed the direction of his life. He was watching us, and we were lucky. We had an Olympic boxing coach training in our facility, says Paul Marinaccio, a former heavyweight boxer who was training there. As Fullwood spent more time training with the group under the tutelage of Anthony Bradley, the U.S. Olympic boxing coach, it became apparent that his raw talent was being wasted simply sparring in the gym. In 2013, Marinaccio, who was also running a boxing promotion company, encouraged Fullwood to take a professional fight. Fullwood was reluctant. I just don't take punches the same way anymore, says Fullwood. I wasn't scared, I just really didn't want anything hurting my health. But in the end, Fullwood took the fight and ended up with a knockout victory to show people that with MS, you can do anything you want to. Afterward, he didn't want to take any further risks, so he stuck to training, and in 2014, he opened Jawbreaker in its current location. Marinaccio had a gym by the same name in Cary, but had closed it to focus on his professional boxing career. He gave Fullwood his blessing to carry the name on. The coronavirus pandemic shuttered the gym for several months, but in July, Fullwood started holding classes in the parking lot with socially distanced bags to hit. He's not been able to work with Larry Tomlinson for much of this year, but recently, the entire Jawbreaker staff went out to visit him and his wife. We consider Remy part of our family, says Sylvia Thomason. He has a heart of gold. I think that anybody could walk up there, and I believe he would help them. This article was edited for Time. Next, we have Fresh Pressed. Millstone Creek Orchards puts a cool spin on apple cider, by Debbie Moose. Making good apple cider isn't just a matter of tossing a bunch of fruit together in a press. Like blending a fine wine, the process starts with knowing your apples. Which ones are sweet? Which are tart? Which have body? And combining them in the right balance. The folks at Millstone Creek Orchards have mastered this art, and their apple cider draws folks from all over the state. The type of apples we use will change, but the recipe is the same. Three kinds of apples, the sweetest available, the sourest available, and a hearty apple with a thicker skin to give balance to the texture and flavor, says Beverly Mooney. She owns the orchards, which are in Ramsur, North Carolina, just outside of Asheboro, about an hour from downtown Raleigh. Her favorite cider combines Golden Delicious for sweetness, Granny Smith for tartness, and the medium-sweet Fuji for body. In the fall at Mooney's 84-acre farm, 100 bushels of apples might go into the hydraulic press each day, becoming about 250 gallons of cider in roughly 3 hours. It sounds like a lot of cider, but it goes fast. To cider fans and inside the farm's popular apple cider slushies. Mooney's late father, Bird Isom, started the orchard in 2001 and opened it to the public in 2004. He'd go cider tasting in the mountains, gleaning knowledge to develop his version, including the idea to use a slushy machine to turn cider into a frozen treat. When most people think of slushy machines, they picture neon-colored liquid on rotation at a convenience store. And yes, it's the same mechanism, but that's where the similarity ends. We don't add any sugar to the cider, and no ice to the slushies. We just freeze the cider on its own, says Mooney. When parents find out there's nothing else in there, they love it as a healthy snack for their kids. In peak season, late August through October, Mooney keeps four machines going at her farm store, making 24 gallons at a time. She sets some aside to freeze, too, so visitors can enjoy the cider pretty much any time of year. During a typical year, the farm will sell about 3,000 gallons of cider, in either liquid or frozen form. Slushies are always on the menu. Millstone Creek cider is unpasteurized, which means it must be kept refrigerated or frozen. That also gives it a unique flavor. Besides apples, the farm grows peaches, blueberries, blackberries, and gourds, and offers family activities like fishing in the pond or picking fruit. Its farm stand offers produce and baked goods alongside their slushies, and live music shows invite visitors to spread out a blanket and stay a while. Like sommeliers describing a Cabernet, clerks at the farm stand can tell visitors which apples are in the cider or slushy they're getting during a particular week. The most discerning of customers call to find out when the farm is pressing cider using their favorite apple so that they can stock up. We have some really passionate cider guests who swear they can tell the difference, says Mooney. They recognize a certain apple from their childhood, and it takes them back. This article was edited for Time. From the shop department, the supply side, United Restaurant Equipment Company serves professionals and home cooks alike to support the Triangle's culinary scene. By Noor Azim. From kitschy food trucks to rooftop bars to cozy restaurants, chances are United Restaurant Equipment Company had a hand in bringing these visions to life. United Restaurant Equipment Company, URECO, is a family-run business, three generations in, that's entrenched in the local Raleigh community in a way few other businesses are. And when you step through the front doors of the No Frills 15,000-square-foot showroom on South Saunders, marked by a jaunty retro statue of a waiter at the front door, you can't help but feel that connection, too. In 1952, Jesse Margulies came home from serving in World War II, bought Steinberg's furniture store on Wilmington Street, and transformed it into URECO. By 1957, they'd already outgrown the space and moved to the current location. Originally a horse barn, Margulies bought it, promptly ripped out the stalls, making way for the inventory to come, and the family has expanded it twice since. You immediately know you're in an old building. You get this feeling of nostalgia when you walk in, even if you've never been here before, says Alicia Dries, Margulies' granddaughter. Dries wears a lot of hats. She's been active in the business for 10 years, and her role has morphed from counter sales to HR to general management, while also handling social media updates, day-to-day operations, and details like beautification. Most recently, she commissioned local artist Denise Hughes to paint a mural on the building's exterior. Her uncle, Howard Margulies, has also been involved in the family business since 1970. and his son, Eric Margulies, currently serves as president. The core clientele of UREco is restaurants, but they handle everything from mom-and-pop restaurants, chains, the local prison system, and the school system. According to Dries, there are two sides to the company. The first is their commercial side, to design or build and supply restaurants. It's where somebody comes in and says, "I have a dream. I've always wanted to own a sandwich shop. Can you help me make it happen?" The second is the retail side, the showroom, which is open to the public and home to a vast array of kitchen gadgets and gear, has historically been packed, but lately it's fallen prey to the pandemic. With bars closed, no one's buying glassware. "Our showroom has taken a significant hit," says Dries. "On good days, the showroom attracts an amalgam of families looking for particular products, restaurant owners restocking or shopping around, and students about to enter culinary school, loading up on baking and cooking supplies." To Dries, the showroom is a space unlike any other. "We're unique. We have some really cool things that you can use in your kitchen and home. And you can be walking in and Jason Smith or Scott Crawford will be standing there. Everybody's talking and laughing. It's not just a place to shop," she says. "It's a spot for Raleigh's culinary minds to come together." So many times, I've watched people having deep conversations, working on issues that have come across in our industry, says Dries. They're mapping things out together and coming together. Its community impact goes beyond their inventory list and showroom. Dries serves on the Wake County Food Service Advisory Board and speaks at a food truck class at Wake Tech Community College. The class was started by Rebecca Robbins, who approves food trucks for Wake County. After witnessing people buy trucks without knowing how to make sure the equipment inside was up to code, or buying excess equipment, they came together to provide an education program that had helped people get into the business without losing money. Normally, the showroom is packed prior to Thanksgiving. Every November, without fail, they have to double their usual supply of hurricane burners, giant stockpots, and thermometers because we've been come to be known as the place to get stuff to fry a turkey. "I would call us a gritty Williams-Sonoma," Dries says. "No pomp and circumstance, just what you need." This article was edited for Time. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Walter Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.